For the next session, we have two speakers. The first speaker is going to be Anthony Bice, who in fact we just heard from. Anthony is a director at Mercer Oliver Wyman's London office and heads its financial effectiveness practice within the European insurance domain. Anthony has worked in depth with major European insurance groups, specialising in the measurement and management of economic risk, capital and value. His recent focus has been assisting leading global insurers in embedding the use of their economic risk and value measurement tools into business processes, including pricing, risk management and strategic planning. And also in this session, will be addressed by Pauline Blight, who is Asteron's Chief Financial Officer. She's responsible for actuarial, finance, human resources, legal, risk and compliance and strategy. I don't know what that leaves for anyone else to do at Asteron. So, Pauline also fulfills the statutory role of appointed actuary for Asteron Life Limited. Pauline's strong finance background prior to joining Asteron includes a role as director at Tillinghurst Towers Perrin and positions as investment banker Morgan Stanley and actuary at MLC. So please welcome Anthony and Pauline talking about meeting the needs of Australia's retirees.
Thanks very much. We're going to start with a bit of a global perspective on how companies in other countries are addressing these types of issues, because they're very much global issues. And then Pauline's going to bring it a bit closer to home and in particular focus on the Asteron product, which was recently launched, which is quite an innovative solution to some of these issues. So we all know that populations are getting older, and that's happening all around the world, and that's really been anticipated for a number of years now. I think maybe what has been less anticipated is the fragmentation of the 50-plus segment. Now, we saw some kind of phasing of lifestyles earlier with Michael's. I've got four phases in mind. It's a bit like razor blade. Somebody will come up with five phases later on today. But really starting a little bit earlier in the preparation phase, which I think is where, you know, it's recognised that a lot of customers are really starting to think about their retirement around the age of 50. And as a provider of product, if you can grab hold of the customers then and then work with them all the way through to the passive retirement phase, then you'll have done quite well. But the challenge here, of course, is that each of these phases has quite different needs. The retirement preparation is still very much about accumulation of wealth. Transition phase is one of the bigger changes that we've seen recently, where customers are now needing much more flexibility. Sometimes they'll be working, sometimes they'll be drawing down. And certainly the new changes in Australia make this much more able for retirees moving into the sort of 60-plus age group. The active retirement, of course, is the trips around the world and all of that, where liquidity is probably the biggest requirement there. And then finally, passive retirement, which is much more around meeting demands for healthcare and so on. If you look at the composition of personal financial assets, one of the key things that really comes out from an Australian perspective is the really high proportion of home equity in the makeup there. And this really, again, you know, we've heard a lot already about reverse mortgages, products that have been tried in the UK certainly and are starting to gain some traction after a bit of a false start. But that then really brings home the need for liquidity again. A lot of the PFA of people reaching 50 plus is actually tied up in fairly illiquid assets. And yet if you look at the different life stages or the different lifestyles that customers might have, it can really range from the extending of the retirement transition, so remaining in part-time work maybe up to age 75. The needs of those types of customers are quite different to people who want to enjoy an early and active retirement, where they're going to be requiring liquidity and flexibility at a much earlier age. And I think one of the big challenges is to adapt to this type of different life stages and life phasing. The traditional accumulate-decumulate model just doesn't work anymore. And another big challenge, of course, to the financial services industry is that we're in the business of selling uncertain deferred gratification. That's a pretty tough sell. And what we've started to see in some of the European markets is a focus much more on customer needs and sort of emotionalizing the sales activity and the product. So rather than talking about financial benefits, a lot of companies are starting to think about more emotional benefits. And there's a model that's up here on the screen of different tiering of emotional needs. And a concrete example of that is, for example, one of the German companies, which is providing a long-term care-type product. And they don't just provide a cash benefit, but they'll actually provide, as part of the offering, someone to come over and feed your cat and water the garden while you're in hospital for a few days. And that type of tying the benefit back to something that the customer can actually understand and see as, yes, that's actually a current need, I can understand what that means, rather than we'll give you an extra 40 quid or something like that and you can work out what you want to do with that. That's a much less tangible type of benefit. So we're seeing quite a lot of interest in this type of area as well. I don't think we're going to get quite to the financial services company equivalent of Nike or Apple in terms of creating this sort of lifestyle halo effect. But certainly I think there's a number of areas in which the financial services industry can progress here. So coming back to product for a bit, the what we call DeSaver product suite really has four main clusters of products. First of all, there's the core asset protection product. So this is coming back to things like the longevity protection, providing some kind of minimum underpin to some retirement income stream. And I'll focus a little bit on this in the next few slides. But there's also other issues as well. Managing liquidity is a core issue, particularly with the transition phase and the active retirees now. Long-term care, we've already heard, is very underserved in many, many markets. Partly because government tends to pick up this one in a lot of markets, but along with the increasing cost of pension is the increasing cost of health, and we certainly can't be certain that government is going to continue to pick up care costs in the way that it has in the past. And then of course the intergenerational transfer. Now, none of these is really particularly new from an insurance company or a wealth manager perspective. Really what needs to be new is the way that we go about manufacturing these products and then delivering them to the market. So just to focus a bit on asset protection products, this is one area where we've seen vast differences in the way that global markets have addressed the asset protection question. On the one hand, you can see down on the bottom left there, the Australian market is really at one extreme where there's very little asset protection products, so very little sort of guaranteed minimum income or guaranteed maturity benefit type product. Really all of the asset protection style of offerings is done via reallocation of assets to and from risky and risk-free assets. So it's a very much placing the onus on the customer with the help of the financial advisor. At the other extreme, on the top right, we see US-style annuity products, which are very modular, very structured, and you actually buy pieces of guarantees. There's a charge that you pay for any type of guarantee that you want, and there's now a very sophisticated array, maybe even too sophisticated. It's a bit of a benefits arms race over in the States, but a very, very sophisticated array of different types of protection products that you can overlay onto the core carrier. Very little in the way of sophisticated advice around this, apart from, well, what's the right product for you to buy? But what we're seeing is, certainly in the American context, is a drift around this spectrum, so advice is becoming more active. And I think what we're likely to see in Australia as well is a move up the curve. So I think we're going to see with things like the Alice product from Asteron, a move towards more structuring of asset protection as part of the broader DeSaver offering, particularly once companies start to focus on beyond the pure accumulation phase and start to think about, well, how can we actually meet the needs of customers as they start to dissave? From a European context, we're still kind of stuck up in the top left corner. There's not really been a lot of product innovation, although we're starting to see a number of companies entering the market with US-style products. Very much a slow burn. A few companies have made a few mistakes in how they go about it, but that's very much seen as the next big thing all across Europe. So just focusing on one of the US-style products, the variable annuity product, because I think this is actually quite interesting. It's essentially a unit-linked or unitized product where you can overlay different types of guaranteed benefits. So it's quite transparent. There's a fee charge for every type of benefit, so you know what you're getting, you know what you pay for. And it really covers all the bases. If we try and think about these sort of emotional needs again, the kinds of needs that customers want, well, they want some kind of protection against market volatility. Now, in Australia, of course, this is a pretty tough sell because we haven't really had market volatility for the best part of 20 years, whereas, you know, in a number of other global markets, people are much more aware of the possibility that stock markets go down as well as up. But that one is still bubbling under the surface. Certainly, asset growth is a core requirement, particularly, you know, as we've heard this morning, if people are going to be living for 20-plus years after their retirement, there needs to be some kind of investment in real assets. You can't just get away with investing in cash. At the same time, the flexibility, the ability to move funds in and out of these products is fundamental. And one of the things that the variable annuity products do is allow you to do that. They're not like the traditional old-style, say, with-profits or investment account products, for those of you who can remember back that far, which were pretty inflexible in the way that they all run. And then finally, of course, the longevity risk. And this is the newest area in which the variable annuity products have adapted to meet the customer needs. So if we look at the types of benefit overlays that you can get with the variable annuity product suite, the simplest one is the guaranteed minimum death benefit. They're all sold as GM something B. So this is the GMDB, guaranteed minimum death benefit. And that can be as simple as return of premium on death, or it can be made much more complicated. Some companies are specialized in bringing in ratchets. So if your fund goes up over 5 years, then it'll lock in at the end of the fifth anniversary, whatever the fund value is there. And of course, you pay more for that type of benefit, but that's fine. You choose which one you want, and you pay for it. The other more familiar one is the accumulation benefit, which is essentially just maturity benefit. Put your money in for 20 years, and at the end of the 20 years, we'll guarantee you a minimum of 2% per annum growth. And I should say before I get on to the next one that although these are called variable annuity products, there's actually very little annuity-like about them. They typically have some kind of... They're deferred annuity products, so they're accumulation products with some kind of annuitization option at the end. But the annuitization option is normally at such penal conditions that nobody actually annuitizes. So some of the providers have actually had this great idea to actually put a minimum income benefit on the end of these products. So there's still the sort of annuitization base which nobody's ever going to take, but you can buy the option to actually have better annuitization conditions at the end of this product. So yeah, we're now starting to get into the more retirement income, longevity type protection products. And then the final one, which is the most interesting one, is the guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit. And this started out as just a way of giving customers access to some liquidity. So you might buy a 10-year product bridging from age 55 to 65 when you expect to retire. And this allows you to withdraw a minimum of 7% per annum of your initial premium. Guarantees that it's going to be a minimum of 7% of your initial premium, plus any upside that the funds get on top of that. And some of the more innovative companies have now extended that to a lifetime withdrawal benefit. So it's now actually starting to look like a very flexible, full retirement income product. One of the UK providers has just launched a product called Five for Life, which guarantees you 5% of your initial premium for life. So you buy this product at age, say, 55 or 60 or whenever it is that you're looking to lock in your retirement income, and it pays out a minimum amount for the rest of your life, but it also gives you access to the upside. And you can get, again, all sorts of different ratchets and deferred benefits and so on that sit on top of this. So very, very sophisticated. Again, priced fairly keenly. It really does bring home to the customers the value of a guarantee or the cost of a guarantee. And that's certainly a challenge. But what it does do is offer a vast amount of flexibility in the way that companies meet these different types of needs. So that's been really quite interesting, and I mean, the Five for Life has caused a bit of a stir in the UK. Not sure yet what the sales volumes have been like. The UK market is very much an IFA driven market, so there's all the challenges around that. I'm not quite sure what happens if interest rates fall, because 4.75 for life doesn't sound quite as catchy. But I guess that's something that they'll manage when the time comes. So just finally, before I hand over to Pauline, we've been looking at this market and these types of products for some time, and really have identified three key challenges for the providers to meet in order to be successful. And there's been quite spectacular examples of companies failing to meet each of these three requirements. The first one is, in some respects, fairly obvious, but it's also one of the biggest challenges, is getting the right proposition for the market. We've seen an example of Hartford in the US, extremely successful writer of variable annuities, imported their VA product suite directly into Japan and created the market out of nothing. Very, very successful there. Tried to do the same in the UK, nothing, absolutely nothing. It was a very low-key entry. They brought a product in, a very vanilla product, directly over from the US, but, you know, they entered the wrong market at the wrong time with the wrong distribution, and, you know, really hasn't been successful at all. So that's certainly a big challenge, and understanding the tax and the regulatory requirements and so on is extremely important. The second key factor here is getting integration across the organization. Because these products are all priced on a modular basis, you really need to understand, when you're doing product development, what the price is going to be. And in order to understand what the price is going to be, you need to be linked into the risk management, the hedging, the actuarial function, and so on. So what we often observe with product development is that there's a group over here thinking great thoughts about new products, and then there's someone over here who, you know, after the product is launched, it does some kind of risk assessment or pricing or valuation and so on. That doesn't work, and we have seen some great examples of people thinking up benefits which they felt were, you know, not going to cost a great deal at all, until some bright spark actually realizes that this benefit, you know, has a cost, has a value, have really exploited it, and the companies have ended up paying out a lot more than they anticipated because they didn't have that sort of joined up organization right from the start. And then the final important factor here, and this is another area where these products are quite differentiated from other traditional products, a lot of the risk is hedged out to the capital markets directly. So you'll find, even for the simpler or the less sophisticated managers of these, they'll hedge about 75% of the capital requirements directly out into the capital markets by running dynamic hedging programs. And I'm sure you can appreciate the amount of technology, the amount of data, the governance structures that you need to sit around these dynamic hedging programs is quite different from what a lot of providers are used to having before. So getting the risk management right, understanding what your appetite for risk is, how much you want to hedge, how much you want to retain, is also extremely important. And, you know, again, we've seen some companies that have not really got this stuff sorted out before they launched the product, and have been burnt by market volatility fairly soon after. So I think if you're, as a provider, looking to jump into this market, and I certainly think it's an interesting product prospect for the Australian market, you really need to think about these three key factors. And on that note, I'll hand over to Pauline, who can take you through a real example of how this thing might work.